This is episode one of Nothing Human Being Something Extra, a Nothing Human bonus episode. Tragic story, comic ending.
Nothing Human Being Something.
Welcome to Nothing Human Being Something Extra, an eclectic bonus collection of shorter form reflections and connections with the focus, as always, on making complex information more accessible to the curious. I'm your host, Michael Minkoff. You can find all the episodes for Being Something Extra and the Nothing Human Podcast on my website, nothinghumanpodcast.com. If I were to ask you to imagine the symbol for drama or theater, the first image that would likely come into your mind is the famous smiling and frowning masks that represented in ancient Greek drama the extremes of human experience. Greek drama was exclusively comedy or tragedy, after all, and this convention has been tightly or loosely held even into our time. There's a quote I've seen attributed to the Colombian novelist Gabriel Garcia Marquez that all great stories are about either love or death. In other words, all great stories are still either comedies or tragedies. Though we tend to think of comedies as stories that make you laugh, and tragedies as stories that make you cry, the conventions of comedy and tragedy in storytelling are a bit more than that. Comedies might make you laugh, but according to the ancient conventions, they are primarily a celebration of life and love and consummation, happy endings. Thus, most Shakespeare comedies end in a marriage or even multiple marriages. Comedies are about the expectation and longing of life and the fulfillment of our hopes overcoming all challenges. And comedies are supposed to provide resolutions where everything works out. The deepest longings of the characters we're cheering for are realized. Tragedies, on the other hand, are about the inevitability of loss and ultimately of death, dashed hopes and unfulfilled promise. Which is why Shakespeare's tragedies nearly always end with all the important bodies dead on the stage. Marquez himself, as can be determined from his novels, believed that comedy and tragedy were inseparable parts of the whole human experience, dependent on one another. But most stories, even today, still follow the ancient conventions. Comedies end in happy and resolved consummation in the hope of happily ever after. Tragedies end in, well, tragedy, with unfulfilled hopes and even death. That's why two fairly recent movies in particular have deeply intrigued me, because of the way they subvert and even reverse the conventions of comedy and tragedy. They are 2017's The Disaster Artist, directed by and starring James Franco, and 2019's Uncut Gems, directed by the Safdie brothers and starring Adam Sandler. If you haven't seen one or both of those movies, here's the obligatory spoiler alert. I'm about to talk about how these movies end. So fair warning if you haven't seen the movies, and also fair warning, they're both somewhat unpleasant movies to watch, though they're both really well made. So just keep that in mind. It's not necessarily the kind of movie that you want to relax and unwind to at the end of a night. It's going to require a little bit of difficulty on your part to get through it, especially Uncut Gems, which is very tense and very intense. So be prepared for that. Speaking of Uncut Gems, we follow the story in this movie of a gambling addict, played exceptionally well by Adam Sandler, who continually digs himself into deeper and deeper holes, trying to avoid the consequences of past debts by taking on new ones. Not a great strategy. Every gamble finds him even further and further in the hole, until, in the end, he bets all his hopes on the most improbable gamble of all. But if, and only if, this improbable gamble works out, he can clear himself of all his past failures and stave off the debt collectors who are becoming increasingly incredulous to his lies and increasingly violent. And if he wins this one last, very improbable gamble, he'll have a fresh start, maybe even a new life. And as it turns out, in one of the most cathartic scenes in film, all the tension, built up masterfully over the whole story, seems to be released when his final gamble actually pays off. For once, he wins this crazy bet and seems poised in ecstasy when, seconds later, a disgruntled fixer for the criminals he's borrowed from, suddenly pulls a gun on him and shoots him in the head, dead. And at first, when I saw this, I sat there stunned. I was gutted that after all of that, his moment of triumph and consummation had become simultaneously his moment of death and tragedy. Even if you've been frustrated by this guy the whole movie, and I certainly was, you still want to see him somehow, against all odds, win. But when I thought about it, I thought about what would have happened if he had gotten away with it. If he had been left with millions in winnings, even after he paid off his debts, and he kept all the wolves from the door, and he had succeeded altogether, and he had been allowed to live. Would this actually have been happily ever after? And the sad fact is, no. This guy would have been in a worse position in no time at all, not even months after his greatest victory, for sure. He's already proven he can't even help himself, and his character hasn't changed over the course of the movie. In fact, this win will probably put him in a worse state than ever, because now he's going to believe more than ever that all he needs is some unlikely win off in the distant future and he'll be back on top again. And that win that he already had was already unlikely that first time. It was very unlikely, basically impossible. And it's basically not ever going to happen again. So how does his life end if not like this? It ends only worse than this. In fact, with this character, this was the happiest ending he could have. Frozen at the very moment of his greatest ecstasy and consummation, with no chance of ever losing it ever again. Somehow, and this takes some genius in storytelling, the Safdie brothers created a narrative where an objectively tragic story actually has a comic ending, where the consummation and fulfillment of hope is sealed by the inevitability of loss and death. This tight-wound ambivalence is only heightened by the casting of Adam Sandler, a comic actor, in this tragic role. It's a brilliant movie. I do recommend it. Again, it's difficult to watch. Now on to The Disaster Artist. Because it's connected, even if it doesn't seem like it could be. They're very different movies. The Disaster Artist is a decidedly different movie, a dramatic retelling of the making of one of the most famous, worst movies ever made, 2003's The Room by Tommy Wiseau. The Room has been labeled by at least one reputable critic as the Citizen Kane of bad movies. No middling movie has ever received so much attention. People make movies about movies that are important, right? But unlike the work of a single or a handful of genius auteurs, The Room was made actually by millions, and not just by Tommy Wiseau. We and millions of others made it what it became. The fact that The Disaster Artist even exists means that The Room has value and importance. It is a very, very bad movie that has become great. But if you have any experience with the history of this objectively terrible movie, the man behind it, Tommy Wiseau, was sincere and earnest in his attempts to make the best movie he possibly could. And his earnest simplicity is on full display in The Disaster Artist, where he is played by James Franco. After the cringeworthy, sometimes shot-for-shot reconstruction of the drama-filled and tempestuous production of the movie The Room, our movie The Disaster Artist ends with a brilliant final scene. Tommy has finally completed his movie, spending millions of dollars of his own money, overcome all the obstacles, and rented out a movie theater for what he hopes will be the triumphant premiere. He takes himself so painfully seriously that you sit poised for the inevitable letdown. As he sits in the back with the shameless expectation of a child, he starts to notice the first of the chuckles and repressed snorts of laughter from the audience. And as the audience gives themselves permission, their snorts turn into roars and waves of laughter. Tommy gets up abruptly, horrified and hurt and crestfallen, and he goes out to the lobby of the theater, where he is met by his friend, who tries to assure him that things aren't that bad, that people actually love the movie. The people are having a great time.
I hate it.
I
No, they're just laughing.
Yeah, they're laughing. Laughing at me.
Tommy.
I tried to open my heart, show them my soul, and they just hate me.
All right, come here. Look how much fun they're having.
Tommy, somewhat reassured, re-enters the theater to hear the audience gleefully egging on his character in the movie to end his life in suicide with a shot to the head. When Tommy, on screen, pulls the trigger, the audience erupts in laughter. The real Tommy, not dead but very much alive thanks to the magic of the movies, goes to the stage then to receive the audience's glowing and enthusiastic ovation. His tragedy has been turned into a comedy. They have crucified him, and they worship him.
Okay. Wow. I'm glad you like my comedic movie. Exactly how I intended.
Nothing human being, something.
Hey, if you've listened all the way to this point, you're probably just, oh, there's somebody coming downstairs. Yep. You got all, yep. Yeah. What's up, bud?
Are you recording this?